can be built, starting from the fragmentation and the atomization, the social atomization typical of a contemporary society, and that leads to gain a new political subject, a counter-hegemonic subject. Strategical tools, and that means rhetorical tools to gain and to build a unified subject which doesn't exist in as a starting point. So, as you can see, and to this tradition belong, of course, authors like Laclau and Chantal Mouffe, with Antonio Gramsci on the background as the main thinker of the hegemonic strategy. So these are two very different strands with a different understanding of the political task, with a different ontology, maybe, too. On one side, you know, community as an ontological presupposition. On the other side, the very idea of a completely fragmented society. Nevertheless, the attempt of Alexander Kupkel is to develop a synthesis with a double movement. On the first side, he said we have to set something like a commoning of the political, and on the other side, a politicizing of the commons. So, as you can see, it's a typical, you know, dialectical movement, which makes the thing very interesting and very, very original, I think. And the best way is that the author will expose, you know, with his own words, the sense and the purpose of this attempt. So I give floor immediately to the author, and after that we will have a discussion where I think everyone is free to speak in his own language. You know, most of us are not able to think in it. They can listen and understand in English, that they cannot think in English.
You can translate for me.
Giuseppe will act as translator. So, but I hope we don't need a translation of the you know, the.
Somebody, you can stop me and ask me to figure to clarify when I talk.
Okay, you can do it if you need it. And Alexander Kupkelis.
Thank you very much for this. You know, kind words. You saved a lot of time for my presentation. So, thank you very much for the invitation, for being here today. Giuseppe Mittarelli and you, and attend this discussion or seminar, however you want to call it. I will start by saying that I am a political theorist by profession. I have studied classics, my first degree, but then my postgraduate studies, all of them were contemporary political theory. And my master's degree was, I did it at the University of Essex when Ernesto Laclau was still there. So I had an influence, but also it was a choice to join such a university that attended Laclau's courses. There was something that attracted me from the very beginning. But apart from being a theorist, I'm interested in politics, but in a different kind of politics. Now, the politics that we associate with movements promoting radical democracy, or movements, social movements that promote today the commons, or a form of politics that is connected with the commons. So, although my background and the book is a book of political theory, I try to address broader questions connected with contemporary issues of collective action and of political and social transformation in ways that could be relevant not only for theory but for political practice. And also this kind of theory, political theory that I practice and I believe in, it draws a lot on philosophy citizens and social movement. I want to, I try to learn from what is going on there, from new forms of politics, the invention of new ways of doing politics that appear on the ground, at the grassroots. So I don't see my work as proposing solutions or grand schemes. I see my work as synthesizing some ideas from political theory, but also from political practice, in order to continue a dialogue around big questions such as radical democratic social change today. How to do it? Okay. So I don't claim to offer any answers about them. Of course, I just try to somehow move a step further in actual debates, both in theory and in practice, around this issue. So, as you have just heard this very good introduction of my and overall outline of the book, there are two main points in the book, the common and the commons. And I use the common because this is the work preferred by Negri and Hart, for instance, the book and Ardo Laval, they prefer the common as a political principle rather than the commons in plural. So, on the one hand, the commons, on the other, politics, political thought, and political practice. Because my main question is how can we rethink and reform and reshape politics by drawing inspiration from various practices and, of course, analysis that have been done around the commons. You are familiar with the word, I suppose, and there are many smaller or larger initiatives around the commons in Italy, but also in other countries such as Spain and many other places all over the world. And then I want to see how the commons enable us to rethink the way that we practice politics and also to rethink traditional schemes of political thought, like the one that we find in Gramsci or even in Ernesto Laclau. On the other hand, my question is how contemporary political theory, dating back to Gramsci or even earlier, can help us to address some questions that arise in the practice and the theory of the commons. And the main question that this book is preoccupied with is how do we construct effective forms of collective agency that can promote the commons today as a broader alternative, not only small size limited to islands of social life for some small groups, but as a broader practice and structure and logic of social and political and economic organization. And one of the main arguments of the book is that we don't find adequate answers to this question. I mean, how do we organize collective and political action to promote the commons today, facing the powers that exist, the status quo, the current form of the state that we have that has broadly an alliance with neoliberal forces, the contemporary form of capitalist market that we have and the forces within this market, and of course the international forces, international system. So there are all these block of forces that are not in favor of the commons, at least in the sense that I understand it, that I will analyze. And so if you want to actually expand the commons and reorganize broader fields of social life, you will find these forces in front of you. And you need to know how to address them, how to make an impact of them in order to foster this type of social change that is connected with the commons. So I want to situate the debate around the commons in this set of questions. We have system of a balance of power in our time of neoliberal hegemony. We have a particular structure of the state in many Western societies. And we have some logics and structures of contemporary neoliberal capitalism. And against them, we want to promote something different, a different way of doing politics, a different way of organizing the economy, who is connected with this idea of the commons. So how can we do that in an effective and more massive way that can scale up? And I think that it is at this point, for this kind of questions, that we can get some ideas and inspiration from the work of Gramsci first, and then those who try to renew his thought for our contemporary condition Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe, among others. Because the theory of hegemony was precisely a theory about constructing a collective force under conditions of relative diversity and fragmentation in the early 20th century in the industrialized West. Also, it was a theory about creating a popular majority that will be able to overturn gradually the current, hegemony of the existing form of capitalism and the state, the Italian state, but also other Western states that were much stronger and connected with a much stronger form of civil society than those, according to Gramsci, that we would find in Russia or in other countries. I think it's my So I think we have some of our questions that concern us today are similar to the questions that concern Gramsci and that prompted him to develop this theory of hegemony as a strategy for constructing a massive political and social reform that would promote an alternative form of social organization, which from Gramsci was communist. So, after this short introduction, I've actually just built on the previous introduction, I will start by clarifying my understanding of the commons. Now, the commons are used in many different and frequently contradictory ways, with a very large umbrella that covers many different things, and they are used for different purposes. Like, for instance, recently, even mainstream political forces, particularly in Italy, have started using this term in order to appear more up-to-date, modern, and so on. And but also neoliberal forces, including the World Bank, have used, or private corporations have used this word in order to present their activity and their logic as more social than it actually is, in order to give a more social face to contemporary neoliberalism. So, and there are also people theorists and advocates of the commons who see the commons as a way of saving and renewing contemporary capitalism. Not as an alternative, but as a way of filling in the voids and the gaps and the crises that contemporary capitalism creates, like the destruction of the social of the welfare state. So we want to cut expenditure, we want to dismantle the welfare state because first of all it's a large amount of redistribution. Okay, we can replace it to some extent with commons, like cooperatives offering at in cheaper prices the same social services that the welfare state used to offer, cooperatives of poor people to help them sustain themselves instead of hanging out on the streets, and this kind of idea, but without changing fundamental structures of the state and the economy. So there is this approach in the literature and the practice of the commons. So we need to draw some distinctions. My own perspective is selective. It draws on some traditions and some approaches. It is not arbitrary because it is based on ideas about the commons, analysis about the commons that we find in the work of Elinor Ostrom, in the work of so-called digital commoners, like the work of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation in St. Bowens, David Bollier, and even more explicitly anti-capitalist commoners from Massimo De Angelis, Joris Kafexis, Silvia Federici, and Nick Dyer Witherford. These people themselves base their own analysis and account on actual practice. So they are not figments of imagination, but they describe in their work, they describe particular practices that you can find, for instance, in the work of in the work of Ostrom, in communities across the world, from Japan to the United States, that manage collectively natural resources, from forest to water, and they do it effectively, to the free software in Wikipedia and the discussion about digital commons, or to struggles for defending the public and collective use of various resources, from industrial resources to natural resources in many countries across the world, initially in Latin America and Africa, where the first onslaught, the first attack of neoliberalism took place in the late 70s. And this is an emphasis that this is the perspective of the so-called anti-capitalist commoners, like, as I said, Silvia Federici and George Caffini. So my understanding of the commons draws from all these people and from the practices of these people and the activities, social activities and social struggles that these people started. There is not like an invention of mine, but it is a political understanding of the commons because it is different from other understandings that we find in those who are in favor of renewing capitalism or of just seeing the commons as a way of promoting actually entrepreneurial activities but with a more catchy word. Drawing on all these people, I find the commons as a three-part scheme that consists of three main parts: a community, rules of self-governance and use of resources instituted by this community, and some form, different forms of collective resources or an aspect of collective life. Because, for instance, in the case of culture, we may not want to talk about resources or whatever, okay, but culture is something that we produce, that we create among us. It's kind of an aspect of our life, so I don't necessarily prefer the use of the word collective resources. We could talk about collective goods. So we have collective goods, communities, using, producing, and sharing this collective use, and specific rules for the governance of these goods and for their production and distribution. Now, these rules may take different forms, but I'm particularly interested, and this is where my political perspective comes in. I'm interested in those types of the commons where the rules are based and promote the equal participation of all members of the community in the production and or the management and the sharing of the resources. So it is a self-managed system based on equal participation of all the members of the community. And it's also the terms of this collective self-management are also fair for those who are involved, sustainable both for the collective good and the environment. And they foster openness to newcomers, to outsiders, and diversity. And I explicitly favor and emphasize these values because you find many forms of the commons that may be democratic and fair for the community itself, but they concern closed communities and homogeneous communities. So this is a type of the commons that we find in older forms of communities governing their own natural resources in their village or in their small city. These are the kind of commons that Elinor Ostrom studied initially, and I don't think that this can be a political project for us today. It has existed, it still exists in some part of the world, but it's not a concept of a form of a community that we want to promote as a political alternative, a closed and homogeneous community. That's why I emphasize these elements: equal participation, equal power of all members, fair terms, are also open and diverse. Diversity and openness of this community. And that's why I draw inspiration from the work of Giorgio Agamben and Jean-Luc Nancy, because they have theorized in very abstract and ontological terms this type of community, which is not closed, it's not substantial, and so on. But they help us to clarify our ideas about what kind of community we are talking about, what kind of community we actually want. So if it is more or less clear, the kind of my understanding, political understanding of the commons, the question for me becomes how those initiatives and practice of the commons in all fields that we can find them, from from digital technology and the internet to actually existing communities that manage the natural resources, to new forms of cooperatives like so-called platform cooperatives and so on, how all these different initiatives and practices can come together in a broader collective front, political front, a broader coalition, alliance, network, how we can call it, in a broader social and political subject that will not only join forces, but will consciously promote this type of political alternative around around the compass, with these specific features rather than without, because you could have a political project to promote the commons as a substitute for the welfare state, while maintaining the current form of the liberal market and the current form of the state. So I'm talking about this kind of the commons as the base of a new mode of production, the base of a new mode of political organization, a new type of community, and the commons as goods that are commands on a basis of equality, fairness, diversity, openness, and sustainability. And this is where I turn to Gramsci and his notion of hegemony, because he wanted to answer this question, having in mind, of course, the idea of communism, not of commons, but we can talk about that. They are not that different. The differences are mainly, as Nick Dyer-Wither has put it, that with the commons, you're talking about the commons, just you don't have to defend all the tradition and all the history of the communist movement. You may want to defend parts of it, and it's a very important tradition that I admire, I particularly, but you don't have to talk about the state, Stalinism, and all the things. Because it seems that it is something different, and it is different. And one of the main differences is the role of the state in the commons. You may have understood from what I said that it is not a state center, a state based understanding of the commons. Interesting thing. And it's also more, and it's also, it is much less centralized, much less hierarchical. So I will elaborate on these differences. So the commons allow us to differentiate this political project, political alternative, from bad aspects of the history of the communist struggle, the communist movement, while maintaining what I think are the most valuable ones, that is collective emancipation, freedom, equality, the collective management, collective property, and collective use of common goods in ways that are promote solidarity, cooperation, but also respect the freedom of all the development of all those who are involved. Now, if we want to turn to hegemony to think the construction of a political subject in our times, then I would very, very shortly talk about the idea of hegemony in Gramsci, and I will focus on the reconstruction of hegemony on Ernesto and the work of Ernesto Laclau and Santalmo. So by hegemony means a Greek word that means leadership. So Gramsci's idea was, how do you create, do you promote collective and political leadership in his social context and the context of industrially developed Western countries? How do you develop a form of political leadership that will push for social transformation in all social fields and will bring together the working class of his time with other social classes, or even with enabling the working class to join the ranks despite its differences or despite the diverse influences that played an important role in the conscience of the working class, like, for instance, the role of the Catholic Church in Italy or in other countries, other influences that didn't enable, didn't facilitate the crystallization of a very strong revolutionary working class concept. So you have diverse representation within the working class, but you have also the need to establish broader social alliances, including the farmers, including the upper and the lower, perhaps even the upper in the class. And in order to be able to create a massive political and social force that will overturn the hegemony of bourgeoisie and of capitalism in the 20th century. And as you may know, and I will not spend a lot of time, but because I suppose you are familiar with this idea of hegemony, he thought it is very important to combine an everyday an everyday struggle in everyday relationships of people, like local communities, all sorts of problems that ordinarily face in their lives, and how we can organize to address their everyday needs and issues and concerns, while of course having a broader strategic vision of social and political transformation in which these everyday activities will be embedded and will connect and reinforce it. He put a lot of emphasis on the importance of culture or the common sense, and how you can transform the common sense. You can use the common sense to reach broad, to address society at large, to speak in terms that are understandable to social majorities, but also transform internally the common sense in a progressive direction. So you select some elements from the common sense, you set aside the most reactionary elements, and you work with these progressive elements, try to synthesize them and to connect them with the more progressive vision of social change. And he also thought that you need, in order to promote the struggle on the everyday level, in the struggle of macro institutions, in order to change common sense, you need to have a coherent political organization whose program was the party. And so the party was the modern prince, as he argued. And he had a certain conception of the party about which we can talk. There is a huge literature and there is no consensus about his idea of the party. My personal understanding is that there are strong elements of hierarchy and centralization. At the same time, you can find elements of plurality and openness and so on, but the aspects of centralization and hierarchy are there. It talks about party generals who synthesize but also direct the entire party and communicate to the middle rank with the masses. And even setting aside how he himself conceived of the party, the party in actual history was this kind of bureaucratic, in most cases this kind of bureaucratic and vertical structure. But his point that we need a certain type of organization to promote this political activity of change on all these levels, the everyday level, the mensual level, the macro institutions, and to promote social and cultural change on an everyday basis, if you need a force that will establish some kind of coherence among all this activity and will give a certain direction and will produce a more conscious and articulate conception of the alternative vision for which we are fighting. I think this is a very important and valuable point, and the question is what kind of organization we can have today that will play this role and will be friendly and appropriate for the commons. Because the way that I and many other people who have an alternative understanding of the commons, the way we see them, they are about, as I said, with equal participation and equal power, so they are horizontal. They tend towards this question of power. They're not in favor of centralization or very strong and rigid vertical hierarchies, and they're also in favor of diversity against any kind of strong ideological community or uniformity. So my question is, what kind of political structure of agency and what kind of organization we can have that plays the role which grants attribute to the hegemonic force, but has been internally transformed in order to promote the politics of the commons, both internally and externally. It is when Ernesto Laclau and Santalvo in 1985 took up again this notion of hegemony for their time, for the 80s, they introduced a number of important transformations. First of all, they said that the party may be important in some context, in some other context we may have other forms. That representative democracy is one of the forms of democracy that we have both in the new hegemonic force, but also in a different socialist society, but it should be combined with direct democracy. But the general move, they criticized a lot and they dropped a lot a class-based conception of hegemonic politics. We can talk about this. I'm not completely in agreement with the rejection of class, but there is something in this critique of the classist understanding of politics that is useful. But I will not go into that now. It is a huge issue in itself. But it is a fact that Laclau and Mouffe criticized and dropped this emphasis on the class as the central element in the conception of hegemony, and they analyzed it as a broader political logic of the way that a new regime is established and maintains force. So we talked about the hegemony politics of Thatcher, and they were interested in a new socialist hegemony at the time of that they write this book, a hegemony that would be constructed around a vision of radical democracy, which at that time again included a socialist economy in the sense of a collective property, collective management of the means of production. So the more abstract view and account of economy, of hegemony, hegemony involves a dialectic, as they say, as Laclau says, between universality and particularity. You have a particular force, could be a party, a social alliance, a social movement, that speaks in the name of universal or general social interests, not in the name of its own particular identity, which is different from the identity of others, or in the name of its own partial interests that are opposed to the interests of others. So this is a key element of hegemonic politics. You have a particular social force, it's not identical with society as a whole, but this force defends, appears to defend general social interests of the vast social majorities and not particular interests. And Laclau phrases that as a dialectic between particularity and universality, in which a particular force assumes a universal function, which is defending general social interests. There is one aspect of hegemony that he isolated and identified. And he also argued that in order to do so, you need what he called empty signifiers that are not totally empty. We can come back to that. Ideas, words, ideas, and symbols that are vague enough to allow different people and different social groups to identify themselves. So, for instance, a very common empty signifier in actual political discourse, even recently, is the notion of change. We have it in the 1981 with a new social democratic party that came to power at the time, but we have had it recently in countries like Spain, the idea of change by Podemos and the new municipal politics was there. It was one of the main signifiers of their discourse. Now, people by change may understand many different things that concern them, but not necessarily the very same concrete thing. These are empty signifiers, like general words that allow many different groups, social groups and actors to identify and separate it. He also said that chains of equivalence are important in creating this hegemonic force. That is ways of establishing an equivalence between different social struggles and different social forces. The first way of establishing an equivalence between, let's say, a worker struggle, a feminine struggle, an anti-racist struggle, is to argue that they have a common enemy, which is the current state, the capital. Okay, so identifying a common enemy enables us to make different particular struggles equivalent among themselves. They are, one of them is for workers' rights, another is for feminism, another is against racism, but what they have in common is that they're against the status quo, all of them. So this creates the baseline of unity for Laclau. But we need to make this unity stronger through some kind of common political action and establish equivalence that is more specific as well. Okay, to create forms of unity that maintain the independence of the struggle, but also create common ideas and practical actual alliance between all these different struggles. And Laclau said that two further aspects are crucial for hegemonic politics. Unequal power, you need to become more powerful than your opponent and your attacking, and representation. Hegemonic politics are the politics of representation. And we can see them from the beginning when he says we have a particular force that speaks in the name of general in. So you have a particularity speaking in the name of something general, society at large, vast social majority. This is the representative function in one of the senses. Now, this scheme of hegemony that was presented for the conditions of the aims, because in countries like Britain, and not only Britain, many other Western countries at the time, the old form of socialist politics have been devalued, but you had several social movements, and the question for antagonistic progressive politics was how to create a unity between all the different movements, and to create a unity in a radical democratic way that maintains their autonomy, independence, and diversity, but also establishes independence. All these ideas serve this aim for the club: establish the unity, maintains diversity, maintains the autonomy of different strategies, and a unity that is much less hierarchical and vertical than those of traditional socialist and communist politics. And I think this attempt to update a more pluralistic and open and democratic terms the strategy of hegemony is still valuable for us. However, it became the target of many critics in the late 90s, coming from anarchists, but also autonomous, Italian autonomous, Harden, everywhere among the first, the very critical, and reject this concept of hegemony, not only in Gramsci, but also in Laclau and Mouffe. And the argument was, in most times, first of all, the new types, more radical and progressive and emancipatory types of collective action that we find from the alternate globalization movement onwards, from the Battle of Seattle, the Zapatistas, resistance in Latin America, for the Cochabamba, for the support of the water, and even more recently, from the year 2011, the Kim Fema movement in Spain, or the Indignados, the Squares movement in Greece, the Occupy movement, the Arab Spring, and so on, is that the argument is that this people reject representative politics. So hegemony is indeed about the representation of a totality by a particular force. So this type of new progressive democratic politics are against representation. So they are against hegemony. They are also against strong idea of unity or equivalence between the differences. They are very much in favor of diversity, plurality, openness, and so on. So the emphasis on diversity and plurality, the rejection of representative politics, indicate that we are moving now on a level of resistance, and some people have even argued the name of the global order of force. We are moving beyond hegemonic politics. And they have rejected the idea of organizing in this hegemonic or counter-hegemonic way. But my argument, I will wrap up with this. What I try to do in the book, and not only the book, more general, in my political thought, and to a lesser extent my political activity, is to try to maintain those elements of hegemonic politics that are still valuable for us today, in order to grapple with this question of building a broader social alliance and creating broader collective strategy, but also to transform those elements of hegemonic politics that are duly rejected and dismissed by contemporary movements. And I think this can be a bit complicated, this attempt to renew and transform politics, because there's a lot of confusion in discourse and in practice. And I will start by explaining some of this confusion and see how I try to transform and transfigure. Social movements have transfigured hegemonic politics today. Let's start with this notion of representation, which is very important. In 2011, the main slogan of the Spanish hegemonic movement was "They don't represent us." And that had been argued and had been actually voiced very strongly even in later anti-neoliberal struggles in Latin America, in Argentina, for instance, at the beginning of the 21st century. Is it? No, those represent, they don't represent. So it seemed to be a very strong critique and rejection of a representative politics. Paul Laclau has argued, and I think it was also the case of Gramsci, that representation, that hegemony means that a particularity without ceasing to be a particularity assumes the function of universal representation. This is at the root of hegemonic relations. I'm quoting Laclau from a book he wrote, a chapter he wrote in 2000. At the root of hegemonic relations, you have a particular force assuming the function of universal representation. So these are the social movements of 2011 rejecting this type of universal representation? I think not. I think what they actually do is they produce a different practice of collective representation. So you have the, what they definitely is that they rejected, they established a conventional form of representative neoliberal government. That you had a government and a political elite making decisions for the vast social majority and in a way that was not responsive to the needs and the will of this vast of social majority. And this is the way actually that representative democracy has functioned in the late, not the end of 19th, from the beginning, from the 19th century until today. It is a particular political representation of contemporary democracy, liberal democracy's functions, not simply that we have representatives, it's that we have representatives that assume sovereign functions over and against those that they represent. They hold sovereign power to make decisions for all the citizens during the time that they hold office. They are separated from citizens, and a direct impact of citizens on political government during the time of government. This is what characterizes and distinguishes the liberal form of representative democracy, because you could have other forms of political representation, like those of accountable and revocable delegation. In many complicated political structures, you may need to send people to other fora, political assemblies and so on, that bring together people from different areas or different fields of activity, but you can delegate them to have a specific mandate instead of acting as sovereign politicians that make decisions for those who represent. So it is my view that the main target of the critique of political representation by these movements was against this sovereign function of political representatives that became the rulers of those, that become the rulers of those who represent, and remained very thinly, very little accountable to citizens during the time that they are in government. And it's very difficult to exercise control over the government of these representatives while they are in office. At the same time, these movements, they made some representative claims, and this was very clear in the Occupy claim, in the Occupy movement. They said we're in the 99% against the 1%. Well, in reality, those who took out on the streets in the United States and North America more broadly were less than 1%. But they spoke in the name of the 99%. This is a representative claim. This is a typical hegemonic claim. It's a small group of people presenting themselves as the defender of general rights. So that's what they did. We have the same interest as the vast majority, it's a small minority. And we come out on the streets and we represent these people. But we don't represent them in the way that liberal governments do. We don't represent the way of making decisions for them. Because the decisions that we make for the kind of politics that we want to pursue and the kind of political discourse we political claims that we want to articulate are made in open assemblies. In open assemblies that try to actually promote openness and diversity and transparency and accessibility to the greatest extent possible. Of course, several times they fail. But there's a very clear aim that we want to open up the practice of decision making and of organizing political action to everyone. Of course, everyone that shares some minimum, some standard features. Okay, they were not racist, they were not sexist, they were not fiercely at least pro-capitalist. But with these exclusions that are important, there was room for a huge diversity of different perspectives and they valued and they fostered diversity and they sought to do it very deliberately. So my first argument in terms of how we transform hegemonic politics is that you still have people taking a political initiative, trying to organize collective action and speaking in the name of society. This is a hegemonic function. But this hegemonic function is performed in a different way. It's not performed the way of a hierarchical, closed organization that is led from the top down and so on and so forth. But it is pursued through open platforms in which, in principle, most or even all citizens could participate, regardless of their social background, regardless of their specific ideologies or identities, and so on and so forth. And my argument here, I want to emphasize this point, this is one of my personal differences with the way that Hardin Negri theorized and envisioned a democracy of the commons. You get the impression, it's not 100% certain, at least in their previous book, 2009 book, The Commonwealth, and to some extent the Declaration of 2012, that a democracy of the commons would mean that all basic infrastructure and main aspects of collective life would be managed collectively and equal by all citizens. Now, if you translate that in terms of our contemporary societies, you can imagine what kind of pressure would put on each one of us if we were to make decisions actually with full collective participation about infrastructures in our city, on the national level, and all dimensions of our life. I do think that a critique from the point of view of representative democracy, but this is not realistic, and is demanding too much from citizens, very virtuous citizens that devote all their time to political activity. I think it would be a pertinent criticism if this is the idea of democracy. The full presence of all the people in all the main areas of social life in order to make decisions and manage them. So I think we need a different understanding of the democracy of the commons, which is a notion of an open platform, that we create open platforms, we create also mechanisms and institutions of controlling them more broadly, not only by the people who are present in these platforms. We create open platforms that allow for the possibility of anyone to take part and make decisions, but do not require that 100% of a certain population take part in the governance of all the collective groups that concept. And actually, it's another argument that I try to make in the book, drawing on political theory about ancient Greek democracy, to the extent that Athens had a democracy only for male, only for Athenians, and only for free citizens and not slaves, which is many exclusions, but you still had one third of the population functioning in a direct participatory democracy. And this democracy functioned the same way. It was the assembly of the ecclesia, as we say, of the demos, functioned as an open platform where people could take part, but not all of them. Actually, the average participation was between 5 and 6% of the entire city, of the entire body of citizens. So I think this is the way a participatory democracy can effectively work. But this is a notion of open platform, the same way that the squares try to function. Okay. Now, very quickly, I'm moving to the two other aspects of new hegemonic politics, and I'm concluding. The question of unity. In traditional hegemonic politics, there's a strong emphasis of unity, exactly because we start from diversity, dispersion, fragmentation. And you want to create strong forms of unity, either by following the party line, a common ideology, and so on and so forth. Now, from the 90s onwards, the new social movement, the Zapatistas, the anti-globalization movement, valorized a lot plurality. And so one of the slogans was that we are against one world, but we want to replace it with many different worlds. So not a single other world, but the flowering of a diversity after the overturning of the collapse of neoliberal capitalism. So how can you combine how can you combine diversity with unity? There are many practical ideas that we can draw from contemporary movements, like this notion of an open space of convergence, which does not exclude people from the beginning, apart from some minimum but important exclusion concerning racism, as I said, racism, sexism, capitalism, but tries to enable all those who accept these minimum principles to take part, so that doesn't have like doesn't implement strong political exclusions in terms of membership and so on and so forth. The promotion of a different political culture that nourishes tolerance, the critical respect for differences, civility, generosity, a more relaxed atmosphere of debate, and even an effective politics of care for the others with whom we disagree within a political forum. The network forum, this has been an argument made to a great extent by Karl Negri, the network forum enables this combination of unity connection with autonomy and diversity, and other people have talked about the distributed leadership, and so on and so forth. And also, something which is quite important, and I think you are familiar with that, is a move away from a unity that is based on a common ideology or even a common and very concrete political program, to a unity that is based on practice, on having, on setting common objectives and fighting for this common objective. This is part of a broader pragmatic term in contemporary social movements. A Portuguese social science sociologist, Boaventura de Sousa Santos, has theorized that in a very good way, this pragmatic term, where he argues that there is an emphasis on common objectives and so on, but also an emphasis on pragmatic solutions to huge dilemmas that have divided the left for decades. Like, what do we do with the state? Are we against the state, favor the state, we want to take state power, we want to develop our activity, autonomy, and so on. And he said, for instance, a pragmatic attitude meant, in the case of several Latin American movements, but we are open and flexible about that, that we try to combine different approaches, that we don't want from the beginning, in order to establish any common action, to agree on this big question. So pragmatic attitude is that we come up with responses according to the circumstances, but these responses are not simply tactical or opportunist. We have some values, we have a vision that we want to promote, and then we make different choices according to the different circumstances that we find. And a very last point. Hegemony, as I said, is about creating unity, and in this case a unity that allows for diversity. It is about representation, but we can have different forms of participatory and open representation. And hegemony means leadership, that the social force that, or a social alliance will lead the struggle for social transformation. Now the question is what leadership will be a different leadership compared to the well-known social party leadership, state politicians, and so forth and so forth. And I think that there are many ideas that we can find from contemporary social movements about how to transform leadership in a more democratic way. So there is a long discussion in the North American social movements about this idea of another leadership that is not only more affective, compassionate, to empathy and so on, but tries to be clear, conscious, and collective about leadership. So if there are leadership functions within a social movement, we want to reflect on them, to be clear and conscious about them, and want to try to distribute the leadership functions to as many people as possible. So another related idea is this notion of distributed or differentiated leaders, where people take the initiative within a social movement or any type of political organization, take an initiative in different areas, and they also rotate in the functions that they play so that more people acquire experience and become for a short time leaders in a policy, in particular domain. So my view is that we should not relinquish the notion of leadership, because leadership does not mean only or necessarily ruling over, exercising power over others. Leadership means also taking an initiative. It also means leading by giving an example. And the reason is, if we are going to have a political organization that promotes social things, there is a need to take an initiative. But we also need, at the same time, when you take an initiative, you act, you may end up acting as a leader that exercises power over others. So we need to avoid this kind of evolution. And there are practice reflections in contemporary social movements about how to avoid it. The notions of differentiated, distributed leadership, reflective leadership, and so on and so forth. Now, I conclude here. Just I add 2 points that I will leave open for further discussion. Points that are not very clear in this book, but I'm working on them more recently, by again taking inspiration and a lot of feedback from what has been happening in recent years in social movements, and in this case more specifically in Spain. I think there are also two further crucial transformations that run across all these changes that I mentioned among politics, and is the emphasis on reflection and the idea of the feminization of politics, which in a way cover a lot of what I have tried to say. This move towards horizontality, this importance of care, more affective and affectionate rather than antagonistic and competitive politics within a social movement. And also the importance of reflection. It was a key feature of the Kinheimer movement at the very beginning, in a different encampments. They created the so-called reflection groups. They were not groups about Easter meditation, although in some cases they also engaged in this kind of thing. But they were groups about conscious reflection from within the movement, about its own practices, its directions, its politics. So I think it's very important in order to be able to address all these issues that may emerge. For instance, the reappearance of vertical power. We need, in order to do that, we need to be able to reflect on what's happening in the social movement, and we need this kind of reflectivity, but also to reflect on how to avoid it and make proposals about it. So reflection addresses all these issues that I have mentioned. I think these are very important terms in recent years, the reflectivity and the feminization of politics, and they cut across the transformations that I tried to map out. So, apologies for taking so long. Okay. Thank you.
No, comincio io, però solo con due prime questioni, poi vorrei tornare.
Io vorrei suggerire che lui suggerisca
che si traslechi
per favorire lui, andrei su su singoli. Allora, primo punto, l'egemonia qui è letta come una strategia realistica. Che incorpora i limiti sulla decisione politica e sull'organizzazione della decisione democratica. In modo molto interessante le obiezioni all'egemonia sono anch'esse di natura realistica,
russo, puoi ripetere un attimo, spazio per l'occhio in italiano.
Le obiezioni all'egemonia che muove, sono anch'esse su un deficit di realismo dell'egemonia.
Okay, so your objection follows the same line, also on the realistic.
L'egemonia è poco realistica poi alla fine rispetto alle sfide che si propone di affrontare. Per esempio, l'analisi dell'America Latina, sia nel libro che nella relazione di oggi, dice che lì nell'esperimento America Latina c'è un gap di forza realistica dell'egemonia. Nella...
The hegemonic critique is too much realistic, and you can discover this looking in the book and also in your relation on America Latina, because in America Latina you can.
Allora, con.
Yes.
Con un passo avanti, direi che è possibile sottolineare il deficit realistico di una teoria dell'egemonia sottolineando un elemento che forse sia nel libro che oggi è poco stressante, poco sottolineato, e cioè il fatto che l'unità politica attorno a cui ruota l'idea di egemonia non è solo l'idea di unità politica, ma è di unità politica statuale.
So one of the goals is that beside the unity in the strategic hegemonic identity, is not only the organizational level, but there is the state.
Yes, it's not the problem of political unity in an abstract term, but it's the problem that in Laclau, in Mouffe, and in hegemonic theories, is the unity is the state of unity, is the unity of state. It is impossible to separate the Mouffe-Laclau hegemony of idea that is the unity of state. Allora, questo comporta che una critica all'egemonia deve affrontare anche un'analisi del processo di globalizzazione contemporanea e della riconfigurazione degli spazi statuali nel processo di globalizzazione contemporanea. Il fallimento della logica dell'egemonia è rintracciabile non solo nella difficoltà che tu illustri benissimo di combinare, se non pragmaticamente, logica della differenza e logica dell'equivalenza, ma nel fatto che il quadro globale oggi rende l'unità politica statuale uno spazio realisticamente inadatto a fronteggiare la trasformazione capitalistica.
So the two main failure of the hegemony, the first you address it very well, and this is the point, this difficult level to take the chain of equivalence and the difference, this is the kind of dialectic, this is perfect, this is something that we say together to Laclau and Mouffe, but there is another point that is the weakest one probably, is that this kind of idea we can use it well, much more in the classical traditional view of the state, but that is what is changing now.
e credo che molti problemi, per esempio anche della fine del ciclo post-occupy, risiedono non solo nel difficile bilanciamento tra logica di movimento e leadership, ma nell'incapacità di afferrare global level of struggles.
So one of the different books that nowadays we are looking in the occupying movement after the occupying movement is not only the problem right of organizational level, the leadership that is a problem, but it's not there, but it's problem we cannot catch a struggle that's always global.
Il primo punto è questo, rapporto tra critica della dell'egemonia e direi necessità politica di una strategia internazionalista. Secondo punto è sul Como, sul Negri Art. Credo che il punto chiave è che la teoria di Art e Negri è una trasformazione, è una teoria sulla trasformazione del lavoro.
Mm-hmm. You ask me if when you want to translate.
Se la prendiamo da quel lato, il loro punto non è costruire una alternativa istituzionale alla democrazia rappresentativa, ma costruire una griglia di comprensione del rapporto tra livello istituzionale e trasformazione della forza lavoro.
So, starting from the middle of that, the main point is that
there is a right. Labor, yes,
but so,
credo che da questo.
So, if it's this, then the point is not to address the institutional transformation, is not their main point. Mm-hmm. Quindi se non è quello della trasformazione istituzionale, come si riferisce a quello del lavoro, non sono che non c'ho la cosa che segna.
Perché ancora non lo so.
No, sulla griglia di comprensione.
È una griglia di comprensione della crisi.
A framework.
La differenza tra le ontologie e la Clau Mouffe e l'ontologia Negri Art. Non è una differenza filosofica o teoretica come la differenza tra la Clou e Nancy Agamben, ma è una differenza di concezione sulla cooperazione sociale oggi e sul funzionamento della cooperazione. Della cooperazione sociale. Questo rende irriducibile Negri Art a qualsiasi teoria della domanda sociale. The social movements are not social issues in Negri Art.
Not the question. The question is central and crucial also inside in Laclau. No,
exactly,
point of view.
Laclau, the notion of demand is effective.
Yes. Analysis, yes.
And this is not.
Questo, tra parentesi, rende impossibile accostare Negri Art e come si chiamano quegli altri due?
No.
Questi ormai si sono tutti a poco. È già
dove la Marx e Engels
Dardo e Laval non hanno una concezione della trasformazione biopolitica della cooperazione sociale. Ok, questo come... terza cosa, proprio una domanda. Nel libro non hai tenuto presente Hasselblad, perché...
The last book of
Credo che da quel punto di vista il quarto libro della trilogia affronta esplicitamente questa combinazione di orizzontalità e verticalità, e quindi volevo sapere che ne pensavi.
Okay, I think that is better than you answered now.
Okay, so I will ask for the last point. This happened, but I don't discuss in assembly. It happened because the book was finished. I was working on the final manuscript. But there is a footnote that recognizes
it.
Okay. And this footnote, I give a hint to what would be my my comment on the question of the foundation of the analysis of Hartenegger, the comment on the transformation of biopolitical biopolitical living. As you may have seen in my short account of Hartenegger, this book, which is a shortened version of an older book, again in English, it is not that I ignore the theory of the importance that they give to biopolitical nature. It is that from my perspective, as a political theorist, this is a critique that has been advanced by Lucknow and by Rancière. This is not enough. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we can develop a political strategy simply mainly by relying on an analysis of the transformation of the group. Setting aside the various critiques that have been addressed to this analysis of the biopolitical transformation. Okay, because you know what? People who say that this is very people who are Marxists and also focus on the social foundations of politics, like Frederick or De Angelis and so on. They think this is a very weak understanding of the people. So this is one thing. The other is that I don't believe that we can have any sociological, economic, or ontological analysis will be adequate unless we believe that politics is like crucially or decisively determined by social processes that predate it. And I don't believe this. I think there is a gap there. And it is the gap, it is this gap that is filled by a conception of the subject and a political strategy. I don't disregard it. I think the whole analysis of the change of labor, so it is important. For me, it is more optimistic and more, it makes like grander claims for the actual transformation of biopolitical labor, but I'm not an economist. I'm an expert on the issues of transformation of labor. But my point is simply that I don't think this is enough. I think it is important. We need to see how labor has changed. But I would take sides with those like often De Angelis or Nick Dyer Witherford, who are interested in transformation of labor, who believe that it has had almost the opposite effect of the change of labor, promoting fragmentation, precarization, that is actually hinders collective action. So this is a big debate on its own. It is not my debate, but my point is mainly, I don't think this it is enough for thinking and organizing political action. That's the only very short point that I make about the assembly. The assembly has very interesting ideas about strategy, horizontality, verticality, and so on, but they don't elaborate on that. Because at some point they say again, but look, we don't need to go very deeply into that because we have the exchange of very political labor, which is in the assembly. The other one, the point about the state and the connection of hegemony with the state, that contemporary transformation or reconfiguration of the state, extremely important. You're right that I don't address it in the book this time. I mean globalization and how it has changed state power, or the extent to which the theory of hegemony is attached to a theory of the state. The main point that I make about this, because the book cannot address in 200 pages holistic globalization and transformation of contemporary cities, it's a topic that requires volumes. Okay, I could have devoted the chapter, but then I wanted to have a specific things and focus. I think it is a very valid point, and something that we need to take into account is the way that we understand counterpolitics and modern politics, definitely. But I have to face responses to that. There is a deep connection between hegemony and state from the beginning, because for Gramsci the whole aim of hegemonic politics is to become state. So it was focused on the state and the national state and so on. So we definitely want to move beyond that, first because the national state is not as sovereign as it used to be. That's one reason. And the other reason is that because this kind of hegemonic politics for the commons does not want to become state. So we need to, but at the same time, although the state should not be the model to which we are moving, or we are adapting our ideas and so on, at the same time, I think there is still a valuable dimension in this older conception of hegemonic politics, which is attached to the state, and it is that we need to engage in state institutions, even if national state institutions, even if they are much weaker than they used to be, even if they are transformed, even if you also have the danger that the state can co-opt you, and this is what has happened in engaged in Latin America, at the same time, you cannot ignore the state if you want to promote a global alternative. And then, of course, you need to develop international dimensions. And also, my point is something that I started formulating in this book, but will be further developed as part of the project that we are doing now with Antonio and others about city politics and the common of the city and so on. I think that the city cannot be the sole scale or the exclusive scale, but it is very important node in a different conception of hegemony, because it allows for this direct massive participation for a different type of counter-hegemonic politics, and allows it to partly engage with the state, but at the same time it can be rooted in the grassroots, in the way that a statist politics, a politics of hegemony focused on the national state, cannot. Whatever degree of horizontality you can achieve in a city, you cannot have it on the national state level, if you don't start from this. And also for another internationalism, I think it has to be an internationalism of states, of more local or regional communities, rather than of national formations. But it is definitely something that is lacking in the book, this resituation of hegemony with a reconfigured state. And thank you for this.
I would like also to say something. First of all, I'm really deeply grateful to Massimo De Andres and Gisò Mendola and every one of you who need this. So I'm deeply grateful because, you know, you always say that, but at the beginning of your lecture you have said that in your project you are searching something new. But the point is that obviously the political follow the law of thermodynamics. So now we are speaking about state, hegemony, party. So the topic and issues obviously change in the transformation. We cannot invent. And we speak a lot of this item here in Salerno, so it's really great. And all right, starting from the point of the collective action. Starting from that, you say, you don't write, I think, but I think that is one of your standpoints, that an action is political only if it's collective. And this is probably one reason, because you don't use a lot of Foucault or other authors. I think that there is this standpoint implicit in your work, but it's a question. So, there is the collective action give us a problem. We can say with a Latin vocabulary, tot caput, tot sententiae. Mm-hmm. Or we can say, and this is the I think the greater critique that you point to some authors, also to Arrigan and Egli, because you say, right, there is not the invisible end of, and everyone agree here, of the market, but there isn't neither the invisible end of cooperation. Mm-hmm. So cooperation is something that is difficult to do, to imagine. And here is the first question, right? You asked what kind of community. Community is probably one of the most complex concepts or concept of the politic. And probably this is another weakest, one of the weakest points of the Mouffe-Laclau point of view. In the last book, Chantal Mouffe, Left Populism, speak about two big differences, one idea of the political as hegemony and conflict, and another idea, the political as trying to be together. She, yes, but she's too much, right, Manichaea. It's not like that. You cannot have probably no kind of organization also hegemonic if you don't address yourself the problem of cooperation. This is probably the reason we say before in the car that this is why in all the populist or many populist experience we imagine radical democracy, but we are not able to do a normal democracy in the side. Mm-hmm. So this is a point. But it's strange that the big theorists of communitarism are, I think, not followed by the social movement. So all social movements speak about community, but they don't use Sandel, they don't use Nancy, they don't use also André Gorz, that maybe can be used. You can. So my question is, they don't use, I think, Esposito. Why do you think that they use this word? Why they speak and they see themselves a lot of common experience as the community? Why they speak about the community and not they speak about organization? Which is the difference? Why they use this word? And I ask this because one of the main work that Alexandros is doing is also a grassroots work and research on the field work with Antonio, but also with other scholar that work in the ERC project, and if he wins this grant, it's really important. So for this reason, I ask you to do this. And the second point, it's the last one, is through the difficult element of how to make this organization. At the moment in the book, you say, all right, perfect, how do we get there? How do we get to our idea of democracy of the commons? So I asked this 6 years ago to G, so that suggested me to read this, so it's your fault that you speak about
è colpa mia proprio che esiste quel libro. L'ho finanziato io perché non c'erano i soldi, perché la terza non volle fare la traduzione del primo libro.
So it was his fault.
La terza disse che non avrebbe venduto, quindi quando si fece la traduzione dei libri di Laclau dovevamo tradurre tutto tranne quello.
Ma chi l'aveva detto di la terza?
No, perché volevano vendere quello con Zizek, quello perché quello è la ragione populista, perché quelli vendevano. E non si restava in tradotto questo, e facevo una colletta e riuscivo a far uscire con quell'angolo Gemoni, perché sennò non usciva neanche Gemoni.
No, dai. That's the matter, because probably this is the book where Laclau and Wolf reflect on that. And here there is another problem of organization. But it's not only the problem, all right, how we go agree together. It's not only that. It's a more deeper problem. And they say one of the limits of the traditional perspective of the left is the attempt to decide a priori the actor, the subject of the social changing, the point of the struggle. In another book, I don't remember which one, Laclau say that the concept of class is counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. So This is probably one of the things that common experience have learned. The subject is a cautious subject. So this is really, really interesting, but take us to the main problem that you talked about. So the problem of unity. It's another fundamental problem of political theory. So we can use the rhetoric point of view. We don't speak about that. But you are other two ideas. And here, this is the question. I think that in common theory is a little bit different. Because you have the idea that to make this kind of unity, that's a process cooperation unity, you have the rules. Ostrom theory and all the new institutional level in the classical framework. And you have another idea that when you speak about organization, when you speak more about the post-capitalistic view of commons, it's something more like the vision, the atmosphere, the idea, we can say the legitimacy. There is the shadow of Carnot between legality and legitimacy. So what I am asking to you, and I'm here, I conclude, I told to you, it's important, it's fundamental probably to use a feminist approach, in particular Crenshaw and intersectionality about that. But maybe I think that to make together universal and particular, we have to use also the claiming of rights. Because the claiming of a right is always something that starts from your specific specific situation, right? I don't want to say participation in English. But if you gain or you claim a right, it's never only for you. So this can be probably something useful, and it's not a case that we are using a lot of time these in different level of common experience. So in Spain, now in Greece with the International Solidarity School, in Italy, obviously. So this can be a...
Let me start with the first. How do I understand politics and whether it's something is collective or collective? Politics is collective for me, but I try to give a broader definition, drawing on a different currency contemporary political theory. In order to make room for alternative forces of politics, because the main problem, not only in political science, in mainstream political science and political theory, but in conventional political thought, the common sense of political thought and societies, is that politics is about the state and the political system, and it consists of specific ways of doing politics, which are the dominant ones. If we want to open up the understanding and the practice of politics to other ways of doing politics, we also need to theorize politics in different ways, and these ways are available. I mean, the idea of doing another politics has been the main motto of the Zapatistas from the beginning. It's not invented. In political theory, we have other conceptions of politics based on different ways of doing politics throughout the 20th century. Now, drawing on them, I put forward a more generic, broad understanding of politics as the deliberate action on social relations. So, in there are cases in which this can be individual. But the collective is always there because it concerns social relations. If it is an action that is that concerns mainly an individual, then an action of an individual, for the individual, that has very limited effect on other social relations, then I cannot see any way why we could describe this as political. But an action between ourselves here and now, or an action in our personal relations that affect the social structures of these personal relations is political, in my opinion, even if it is pursued and taken by one individual. So it doesn't have to be always a collective subject acting on social relations, but this action has to be on social relations. Otherwise, I really don't know why we would call it, if it was, it starts from individual and it ends in individual, why this could be political. So, Now, then you mentioned Laclau and Mouffe and how Laclau and Mouffe and Laclau, in reality, have a Manichaean understanding of politics, two different conceptions. Politics are either about antagonism, division, power, coercion, or about community collaboration, consensus. It's either or. And because community collaboration processes do not work, or we find a lot of conflict, or we need conflict in order to change society, this is a bad understanding of politics, and we draw it. I'm completely against this approach, and part of my theoretical work in the book is trying to deconstruct it, both internally and externally. I think that these are aspects and manifestations of politics, of consensus and division, that belong to this broader understanding of politics. Because when you act in social relations, you may act in ways that are consensual, or you may act through conflict, division, and antagonism. And apart from that, within a historicist and social constructionist ontology, as in principle they say that they formulate in their work, you cannot make claims about the essence of politics, transhistorical claims and so on. Okay. Community. Why do different social movements or practice initiatives around the commons talk about community? I think this is an expression of an urgent social need to reconstruct social ties. And this is a very important domain. In my view, we don't need to drop the discourse, the vocabulary of the community, but we need to emphasize and to work for different understandings of the community. Exactly because we have closed and homogeneous communities, or the vision and the dream and the desire for such kinds of communities, and open, diverse, even conflictual and heterogeneous communities. So the first vision is the vision of conservative communitarians and nowadays of nationalist and xenophobic right. So one way to fight this return, this atavistic return to the desire for closed communities, internally homogeneous and so on, that have never existed in reality, but anyway, so this way to fight this atavistic desire, which we know is very dangerous and is a key political issue now across Europe and many other countries of the world, is in my view, to do as these social movements do, to maintain or reclaim the vocabulary of the community, because it shows this demand, this need to construct, to forge social relations, solidarity, but to do it in a different way, to advance a different understanding and a different practice of the community, having these features of openness, diversity, and even making room for internal conflict and deep. Now, turning to the last question about the organization. So you wanted to make this point that a way to achieve some kind of understanding, agreement, and common action today, apart from rules and a common vision, we need to claim rights, because rights are not necessarily individual. I would have nothing against that. And actually, I think that this has been done especially in the Spanish context with the municipalist politics, that from the beginning advanced the notion of the commons, even in the Italian, Barcelona and Comú, but at the same time, if you read the program, they talked a lot about the rights. Right to housing, right to health, so the right discourse was there. So you could have this kind of, you could see this kind of combination of commons and rights, and also, you know, the right to the city has been prominent in the whole discussion about commons and the city. So I don't think there is kind of, I think that it has been used, and it is really something constructive and so on, and it's politically meaningful.
This starts life from what we were seeing yesterday, and from a more political economy point of view about state, hegemony, and so on. Start from the Polanski's understanding of the state as a crystallization of social power relations. So the state is not some kind of reified element out there, but the crystallization of social relations, And on the other hand, many have stressed the critical importance of the state to processes of globalization, of neoliberalization, and I think that's also the idea of Poulantzas, of this authoritarian statism thing is really important today. It's even more than in the late 70s, because it's actually the reality of the transformation of the state. But the state also has, in terms of ideological power, and this may be Althusser as again something to tell us about the ideological apparatus of the state. So it is, this is more a comment, the idea that the pragmatics of engaging with state institution, I think it's the right direction, and but we should like deepen the direction and also have more insights about how the state really works in the global economy. If we, for example, have a clue on international finance and all the thing concerning the interest rates, so how surplus value is stolen from, in particular, the working classes, and then it goes to the investors and all the stuff about credibility. So we, in this case, we see the critical importance of the state, but also in policy sectors, for example, like taxation or the labor policy. Of course, all the precarious types of contracts come from that level. On the other hand, I'm really fond of the Polanyian, of Karl Polanyi, vision of the crisis of liberal order, and I think that the Polanyi understanding of the crisis of liberal order still matters today. He stresses two elements. One is the finance, the high finance. The other one is the idea of unregulated markets and the destabilization potential of unregulated market. And I come from to another thing, that the demand of social protection, like society needs to protect itself from the violence of markets and unregulated markets. So my question is this one. I mean, now a cleavage is opening, and how an hegemonic strategy enters into this kind of battle about the social demand of protection, and that can take some form. For instance, in Italy, I think it's quite clear that it's taking a reactionary form with the League and the Five Star Movements, even that there are some contradictions in there. But yeah, if you can maybe expand more on this.
I think it's absolutely fundamental. It has been, the demand for social protection, the need to solve four different forms of social security to address and fight precarization. These are key battlefields for any contemporary agenda. Now, of course, they should be pursued on the level of the national state, but if we also want to partly refocus the hegemonic policy, not against only states and so on, we need to see what can happen on the local level, because this has been a main part of the agenda of the municipalist platforms in Spain. I mean, to restore to the extent that is possible on the municipal level different forms of social protection. This has been key. So I think it is absolutely crucial, and it can, but we need to combine more direct forms of social protection on the local level with those that will come from the central state and will be supported from the central state. So there's a lot of room for action on the level of the city. Now, taking my cues from that, I want to argue in general an element, a very important element for me of hegemonic politics, even, and you can see it even in Gramsci's account of hegemony, is this attempt to combine the struggle, political activity that responds to social agencies, an urgent social need of the moment to combine this with a broader vision. There is this bridge between addressing social agencies and embedding them in a broader vision of transformation that is fundamental for hegemonic politics. So what you are talking about concerns is the response to urgent needs. If you don't do that, you cannot have effective hegemonic politics. They are not just about playing, enjoying ourselves, or just dreaming about the future. They are about social struggles, social needs, urgent social needs of the moment. But if you only address them without incorporating them in the broader political strategy, in the broader political vision, then you end up with a reformism which, in my view, it could be considered even unrealistic in our times, a short-term reform. Who is going to support it? Who is going to pursue it? For what purposes? And so on. Traditional social democratic forces and central left-wing parties are not either able or interested in this kind of politics. So that's why the most moderate demands for restoring schemes of social protection have been voiced by parties that appear to be radical today, although they are not. Starting from Podemos to Melanchon and so on. This is the main point. That we need to restore social protection. For me, the difference is precisely to do that and at the same time to embed this in a broader vision and involve, mobilize people in the ways that you struggle for social protection, in the ways that you offer social protection. Because the difference that the commons, the logic of the commons makes in terms of social protection is that there is an attempt to collectivize, to manage collectively the structures of social protection, which can be also a way, under given conditions, of offering better social protection. Depending, I'm very much in favor of the distribution, struggling for that. We need to have funding for any effective type of social protection. But in addition to that, it is very important to have different ways of managing whatever infrastructure and structure of social protection. Otherwise, you will tend to the bureaucratic forms of the past, which are legitimate, but they are not related to any transformative issue.
Probably, if we take the standpoint of the role of the state, we can line the biggest difference between also scholars that address the common theory. And you can have, they are not alliance, but you can say to the same level Negri and Adrian Ostrom and Ugo Mattei, and on another level you can have Rodota for maybe, I think, I don't know. Is the river.
By the way, coming up to the first question about the transformation of the state, my personal view, which is not explicitly articulated in the book, but it's my personal view about how we can come to grips with all the different levels in which political action and social struggles are being today, is in an extremely complicated context. You need to have action on different scales and combine and articulate them. You cannot set aside the national state, but you also need international alliances and collaborations. And if you want to have more participatory common democracy, you need also to get involved on the local level. But without remaining isolated on the local level, without becoming different from the national level, and by developing international alliances. So this is very demanding, but this is the challenge of our situation.
L'impressione che ho è che oggi tutto il dibattito su questi differenti livelli di decisione politica, eccetera, incrocia quello dei commons. Incrocia quello dei commons, tutto dentro il dibattito che c'è tra su estrattivismo, neoestrattivismo, e cioè sulle trasformazioni della politica, dell'economia politica, è lì che, infatti anche il tuo libro lì con Federici e gli altri deve parlare di economia politica. Io penso che quello è un passo da fare, perché se no la discussione su democrazia e rappresentanza in termini che sono quelli di Lanzière, eccetera, soffre una difficile presa sul dibattito estrattivismo, neoestrattivismo, che invece dialoga molto bene con il ritorno dei commons. Quello alla Lanzière è tutto già spostato sull'istituzione e sui limiti. Puoi fare una politica della visibilità, ma non un'economia politica della visibilità, a partire dal discorso sulla rappresentazione alla Lanzière, mentre abbiamo bisogno, secondo me, di una economia politica dei commons e di un'economia politica della visibilità. E lì quelle armi ranzieriane di questo dibattito qui sono un po' spuntate. Anche sull'intersezionalità che tu dicevi. Strano, perché quel libro è tutto pensato per rispondere al problema dell'intersezionalità. Nell'85 il loro problema non è tanto che è astrattamente fallito il marxismo, ma è che le domande sociali, i movimenti sociali sono ecologista, femminismo. Quello è un libro non scritto neanche sulla traccia del populismo sudamericano, ma è scritto parlando con Stuart Hall nella Londra globale giamaicana. Il problema che c'hanno in quel momento è l'eterogeneità sociale. E però quel libro lì non ha aperto la strada a riflessioni sulla intersezionalità, che invece sono nate per via ecologia politica, per via recupero del femminismo materialista, Federici, della Costa, eccetera, perché lì l'eterogeneità è bloccata da una diffidenza metodologica per l'economia politica in quanto tale, che ha bloccato, secondo me, la loro riflessione, li ha portati poi agli esiti di autonomia del politico. E
non
solo del politico.
I also think an attempt to use some ideas from this book and the notion of hegemony within political economy and feminism has been made by Graham Wilson. And it's an interesting work, not necessarily an answer to the question that we have raised, but it remains within the field of political economy and introduces a politology that has been informed by its ideas. But I also, if I understood well, I think it's very important the point that you made, that the commons can act as a bridge between political economy and democracy. And even in political terms, you see that if you integrate this level of thinking about the commons on the local level, communities managing their resources, most communities who do that are against extractivism. Not all, but most. So if the commons become part of a broader counter-hegemonic bloc, then you will have several towns, cities, villages, regions acting against extractivist logics. Again, not all of them, because I work in the north of Greece, and next to the Thessaloniki we have all this tragedy with the mining activities in Chalkidiki, and the local communities are divided. I have been many struggles against the mines that destroy the natural environment, but there are people who live from, make a living by working for the mines, so the local towns and villages are divided into two. So it's not, there's no guarantee in politics in any way, but it adds a pressure, adding the commons really effectively in a broader economic group, it adds a pressure against extractivism and in favor of the environment in general. That's why Ostrom has been used by ecologists saying, look, this is a way not only to manage collective resources in a sustainable way, but it's also a way of countering statist and corporatist and neoliberal logic about the use of natural resources, because local economies do not want to destroy not to exploit and extract their local resources because they live with them. So the husband, Ostrom has been used because of this in political ecology, because of this importance of natural commerce, the emphasis on sustainability.
I tried to express it in English, and I apologize for that. it seems to me that the deepest insight of Laclau, and at the same time the most dangerous one, is the idea that to construct a political, a counter-hegemonic subject, to construct the people, we need to draw an antagonistic frontier inside of the population, inside of the political community. So it's not like in the tradition, a frontier between the political community and the other, the external one, but inside of that. With other words, we need a common enemy. We need someone to hate. And that's, I mean, that's, I think, the main point in his idea of origami. And this is, of course, very, very dangerous. And I mean, I have the impression you try with several tools to avoid this. And my answer is, how? I mean, how can it work without that? Because, I mean, the main point is, we are talking of an empty community. And this idea is the people in a hyper-modern society have basically nothing in common. They don't share anything. So to build a unity, they need this kind of frontier. So you can neutralize that if you say, well, it's not really an enemy, it's an adversary, you know. But this is not so different from the liberal tradition. I mean, the idea that the only way to build a majority in a modern society is to have a majority of minorities, so an overlapping consensus, is a typical liberal idea. So maybe you simply stay on this terrain of radical liberalism, like Dewey created democracy and so on, and we know which are the problems and the difficulties of this tradition. Or, I mean, the other way is to build something like a rhetorical image of a threatened majority. We are the people, but there are inside of the people enemies which represents, you know, the global powers. So they seem weak, they seem minorities, they are not. They are the instrument of the global power and so on. I don't see how the idea of an hegemonic counter movement can avoid this dilemma. And I mean, the suggestion of Giso goes in a quite different direction. That means we need to reflect on the political economy to find something which is not an empty community. You know, groups of people who really share, you said, wants to make a living together. I think this is a very good expression because it's very, you know, an ambivalent expression. On one side, it's a simple economic thing. We want to make a living, we need a job and something like that. And on the other side, that means we want to share life. We want to build an image of life which is the same for everyone. The only problem on this direction is what Eleanor Ostrom stresses all the time, that works only in very small groups, because they need to share a life, which is not not easy for, you know, for global societies. And I really don't understand the way you try to avoid this different paths and to connect them at the same time, even if they are so different.
And there are different aspects to what you said. I think one is whether the adversary leads us directly to liberal democracy, whether we can have hegemony without antagonism, and what kind of other community that we can have that is not empty. There are many different levels. I'll start with the role of antagonism. I do believe that in order to be a counter hegemony, which means a block for social, broad social alliance for social transformation, you need to have somebody and something that you oppose. I mean, otherwise, what kind of transformation? Somebody or something that you oppose. This is opposed, just opponent. If you want to transform the status quo, then the status quo is your target. Then how can you engage in any process of consciousness and active transformation without saying, I want to change this because I don't like it, I want something better. So by definition, a counter-hegemonic transformative politics has targets. It is targeted against something. Now, there are different ways, and this is how things get complicated, different ways of constructing the enemy. One of the reasons why Lemov introduced the notion of the adversary in the place of the enemy is because the tradition of Carl Smith, from which he drew all these ideas about politics as antagonism, friend, enemy, relation, and so on, the enemy is, by Smith, is clearly treated as somebody in our actual political interaction, somebody that we can physically exterminate. He says, Smith says that this relation, friend and enemy, implies that I interact with my political enemy in a way in which the possibility of physically exterminating the enemy is always alive in our interaction. We may always reach this end and exterminate the enemy. Now, Mouffe didn't want to have this kind of antagonistic interaction where the enemy can't be exterminated. So she replaced that with a notion of the adversary, which is like an opponent, to, political opponent that we have within institutions and principles of liberal democracy. But this shows that there are different ways of constructing the enemy. For me, the most important way and the most politically productive is to have targets and enemies, but these targets and enemies should be institutions and social systems, and not persons, not individuals, not even, or even we can have a class enemy, but in ways that clearly differentiate people, individual, from the notion of class, which is a social structure. So you can have an antagonistic politics that is targeted, that has as its target a certain social system, a certain part, a set of social institutions, even political logics. Say, we are against racism. Racism becomes an opponent. Those who occasionally express racism become opponents, but then you need to differentiate between the person and the racist behavior. So yes, when you have critical transformative politics, you must have enemies, even enemies that you want to exterminate, but it's very important that we draw this distinction, which has been made in the politics of socialist, revolutionary, communist in the 20th century, between social structures, social systems, and people, individuals occupying these positions. And definitely, in our times, I think it should be extremely important to focus on what, to the extent that is possible, to peaceful confrontation with the individuals, not the institutions, but the social structure, the system, and so on. On the other hand, the problem with Mouffe is not, my problem with Mouffe is not simply that she cannot make, she doesn't make this differentiation. It is also that she equates politics with confrontation and division. She says, this is politics. We have antagonistic division at the center of politics. Consensus can only be a partial consensus, but has to be conflictual consensus. We disagree that we agree, or we agree that we disagree, but there's no possibility of a more substantive agreement, a greater agreement, and value, and an emphasis on the value of collaboration, for instance. For here, this is not political. Okay, I think this position cannot be sustained even in theoretical terms. I mean, an argument do not stand up to critical discussion, but in political speaking, it is feasible to combine both the politics of a consensus agreement and the politics of confrontation. And this is something paradigmatically pursued by recent social movements. When they put a lot of struggle and a lot of effort in promoting consensual deliberation among the senses, with all the problems and difficulties that this creates, and at the same time they had the politics of confrontation against the external enemy. So you can have different kinds of politics of antagonism or consensus on different levels and different fields and different communities. For me, the way to the best form of a counter-hegemonic antagonism today would be to oppose, as I said, political systems and political logics, and without targeting and definitely without exterminating individuals and social groups. And at the same time, we try to pursue a non-antagonistic politics within a different type of social organization. Of course, I know it is difficult, but some moves in this direction have been done and are being done by different groups, initiatives, and movements. Now, the other question about the type of a political community that we can build, if we have. We start from heterogeneity and we have large-scale communities, larger communities and small ones about this question. I think this has been, it is the part that I referred to at the end of my presentation about how you construct unity out of diversity and you maintain diversity. That it has been a main challenge, problem, and difficulty in social movements that have been trying to do this, to achieve a level of unity and common action and convergence while respecting their differences. And there are practical ways of doing it, even among great diversity. As I said, a different political culture. This is very important, because we think that political culture is something, I don't know, superficial, ideological. This is nonsense. It's very practical. It has to be practical. If your attitude is that we all need to agree on my position because it's the best, you cannot achieve agreement in a contemporary context of diversity. If your attitude is that let's achieve some agreement, and I'm going to make concessions because I don't possess the whole of truth and so on, this may lead to partial agreements and conversions and so on. So this emphasis on culture is one of the ways of building more substantive and concrete community conversions. And the other is what I called, it's not only me or social movements, I call it pragmatism. That is an emphasis on setting and achieving common objectives, which creates a community which is not a community of identity, it's a community of action. Okay, this guarantees unity, no? No. But it is a way of dealing with diversity without annihilating diversity and without remaining to an empty unity. Okay, this is a concrete unity in action of action. And it happens to some extent.
Thank you.
Thank you for the comments. Taking the time to
Thank you. The how can you lead a force to the same fluently together?
Political economy of force.
Sto scherzando.
Ok, posso sentire.
Sì. 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 Sì.